Έφτασε η στιγμή να σας μιλήσω για την εμπειρία μου στο Minds Park Event της Αλεξανδρούπολης. Το event καινοτομίας και marketing που πραγματοποιήθηκε στις 20 και 21 Απριλίου και όλοι όσοι με ακολουθείτε στο Instagram ή το Instagram του Γιατί Όχι, το Instagram του Minds Park, έχετε δει ήδη ότι έχω πάει εκεί και έχουμε κάνει 6 podcast με τους βασικούς ομιλητές. Το Minds Park ήταν μια αποκάλυψη για μένα, θα πω. Να σας πω καταρχάς ότι ξεκίνησε από την Αλεξανδρούπολη, αλλά επειδή όπως όλες οι ωραίες πίθες ανοίγουν πυρκαγιές, δεν περιορίστηκε εκεί. Πέρυσι ήρθε στη Θεσσαλονίκη, όπως και θα ξαναέρθει φέτος στις 11 και 12 Σεπτεμβρίου, στο πλαίσιο της Διεθνούς Έκθεσης Θεσσαλονίκης, με τιμωμένη χώρα την Ινδία φέτος. Λοιπόν, το Minds Park είναι ένα διήμερο πάρτι, θα το πω, δημιουργικότητας, καινοτομίας και marketing. Την πρώτη μέρα είναι οι βασικοί ομιλητές, οι οποίοι είναι διαφορετικοί, είναι διεθνούς εμβέλειας, βρίσκονται στη σκηνή και μοιράζονται εργαλεία, τρόπο σκέψης, νέες τάσεις και πολλά πολλά ακόμη. Και τη δεύτερη μέρα είναι η μέρα της εμβάθυνσης με διάφορα workshops. Το σημαντικό είναι όμως ότι το Minds Park δεν είναι ένα event μονόδρομο. Είναι ένα γεγονός αμφίδρομο, δεν μιλάνε δηλαδή κάποιοι μόνο και εμείς ακούμε. Υπάρχει διάδραση, υπάρχει μοίρασμα, σύνδεση και κυρίως δίνει αφορμή για διάλογο και συζήτηση. Δηλαδή η δουλειά που γίνεται την ώρα της παρουσίασης, την ώρα της ομιλίας, συνεχίζεται και στο διάλειμμα, και στο διάλειμμα για καφέ, και στο φαγητό, στους διαδρόμους. Θα δείτε, είναι μια εμπειρία το Minds Park. Θα μάθετε, θα γνωρίσετε, θα συνδεθείτε με πολλούς και διαφορετικούς ανθρώπους από εσάς. Αυτό είναι το σημαντικό. Και η αποκάλυψη είναι οι άνθρωποι του Minds Park. Και οι άνθρωποι που το διοργανώνουν. Οι άνθρωποι που δουλεύουν γι' αυτό. Οι ομιλητές και οι συμμετέχοντες. Είναι όλοι σε ένα mood μοιράσματος και να μάθουν. Θα δείτε ότι είναι μια εμπειρία που δεν τη φαντάζεστε. Να σας πω για τα εισιτήρια, τα οποία από τις 16 Ιουλίου έως τις 9 Σεπτεμβρίου είναι η δεύτερη περίοδος και είναι τα regular εισιτήρια. Από τις 10 Σεπτεμβρίου θα βρείτε τα εισιτήρια με τιμή εισόδου. Τα βρίσκετε όλα αυτά στο mindspark.gr μαζί και με τους ομιλητές που είναι φέτος, που από ό,τι βλέπω, αν και δεν έχουν ανακοινωθεί ακόμη όλοι, έρχονται και άλλες προσθήκες, είναι συναρπαστικοί. Και να σας πω για τα 6 podcast που κάναμε και θα ακούσετε, είναι με τους Nick Godbehere. Ο Nick είναι Behavioral Insight Expert της εταιρείας Hits Marketing UK και έχουμε μιλήσει για το πώς αποφασίζουμε τι θα αγοράσουμε, αν θα αγοράσουμε το ένα προϊόν ή το άλλο, τι μας επηρεάζει, τι εκμεταλλεύονται τα brands. Με τον Αποστόλη Αϊβαλή, γνώριμο της εκπομπής, έχει ξανάρθει. Ο Αποστόλης είναι CEO της No Crunch, Digital Marketing Expert και μιλάμε για το πώς να βάλεις την επιχείρησή σου στον ψηφιακό χάρτη. Για τον Γιάννη Καλογεράκη, CEO της JMK, ο οποίος είναι ανθρωποκεντρικός corporate trainer, θα μιλήσουμε για τη δύναμη των millennials. Με τη Μαρία Μπόζογλου, CEO της Italy Lines και τον Τάσο Τζίκα, πρόεδρο της Διεθνούς Έκθεσης Θεσσαλονίκης και της Τεχνόπολης, μιλάμε για το ταξίδι του στο επιχειρήν και φυσικά με τον Θοδωρή Σπηλιώτη, ιδρυτή του Αθωνικού Management και συγγραφέα του βιβλίου «Ο μοναχός που έγινε CEO και έχει ξανάρθει στην εκπομπή ο Θοδωρής», μιλάμε για τρεις αρχές του Αθωνικού Management, οι οποίες μπορούμε να τις χρησιμοποιήσουμε τόσο στην επιχείρησή μας και στη startup μας, αλλά και στη δική μας αυτοβελτίωση. Να ακούσετε όλες τις εκπομπές, από όλες έχετε κάτι να πάρετε, είναι όλες διαφορετικές μεταξύ τους και θα τα πούμε στο Minds Park το Σεπτέμβριο. Φιλιά πολλά! Nick, welcome to the show.
Thank you very much.
Nick Godbehere, we are at the Minds Park.
We are.
Nick is a market research and behavior change professional and we're going to talk about emotions and brands. And I'm excited about this.
Okay, yeah, we can see where we get with this, yeah.
So how we decide to buy one thing over another?
It's not a simple process,
okay,
shall we say. Because, I mean, I'm not a neuroscientist, so I don't understand emotions on a kind of a biological level.
Okay.
My position on things is that I work for a behavior change organization.
Okay.
So I need, as a psychologist, to understand emotions and how they impact on some of the projects that we do. So I'm not, I wouldn't say I'm an expert in okay. emotions at all.
I really like when someone tells me that he's not an expert. I really, really, because we're constantly learning exactly. every day. That exactly. is why.
Even this morning, I've been reading more around the subject because I suppose I've only touched the surface of
yes.
some of the areas that are really of interest, but I've found information and research studies that I thought would be relevant for my work that I undertake for the company I work for. So in terms of what drives us to buy certain products or services, that's a very complicated matter.
Yes.
And it also is based around what you understand emotions to be.
Okay.
Because there's a debate.
What are emotions?
And how they form is a debate among psychologists and neuroscientists.
You know the movie, The Inside Out?
No.
Disney Pixar with the
animation. Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah. I've not seen that for a long time when my children were very small.
Okay.
So it's to simply say this is what would drive purchases
mm-hmm.
Is really difficult, because if I knew that, I would make millions quickly.
True.
But what seems to be coming from the evidence and the research is that emotions clearly play a big role
mm-hmm.
in our mind, our body, and our decision making.
Okay.
Whether that is the emotion comes first,
yes,
and triggers behavior.
Okay.
Or whether we become aware of a situation and almost look at ourselves inwardly, and then the emotion forms as we judge the situation.
I want examples. Okay. The first I can help comes to mind when you see, for example, a car, Fiat mm-hmm. 500.
Yeah.
And I think we women, that when we see this car or even a Mini Cooper, we say, "How cute!"
Yep. Yep.
So that is an emotion.
It is.
We don't say that if we see a Volvo, for example. Uh-huh. But when we see a Fiat 500, we say, yeah. How cute.
Yeah. And why do you think that is?
I don't know.
Well, if you look at the design behind this, and again, I'm not a designer, a creative designer. But if you look at some of the history of design of cars, you look at a Mini or a Fiat 500, and the shape of them is that they're curved.
Yes.
They have big eyes.
Yes, they have big eyes, yes.
Which stimulates...
It's like smiling, I don't know.
That stimulates, particularly in females, supposedly, the links to a baby. Because babies have...
Yeah, big, maybe you're right.
Round faces, big eyes. And we are programmed as humans to recognise faces.
Yeah.
That's why you'll see on Facebook and YouTube, where people take pictures of... inanimate objects like dustbins, garbage cans that seem to have a face looking at them, and you can see almost like two eyes or something similar. We are programmed to recognise them, and particularly I think in the females who are, you know, the mothers of children, that kind of round, big, wide eyes attracts us and makes us feel that warm feeling to it. Whereas if you look at some of the cars that are and this is something that I'm going to mention in my session later. Thank you. Is that when you look at cars that are advertised more towards males or families, there's one thing missing from any TV commercial that isn't in the advert,
yes.
in the commercial, and that's any other cars. There's only one car on the road. So that's promoting the emotion of
freedom.
That
is so
freedom.
True. Yes, yeah. yes, that
and
is so true.
The pleasure to drive and the experience of driving. But in reality, we know that roads are busy and packed with cars.
Yes,
and
you're so
jams,
right.
But they don't want to sell us that kind of emotion. They're playing on the emotion of freedom.
They want to sell us safety, security, I don't know what else.
Yeah, it's the kind of the essence of freedom and exploration.
Yes, true.
And that triggers an emotion. They don't tend to sit there and tell us the dimensions of the engine or
true.
The size of the wheels and the tyres, what size they are, the technical specifications.
Mm-hmm.
That's probably unlikely for most people to trigger any response in them.
And that is an example for the first thing that you mentioned.
Yeah.
And the second one?
Well, this goes back to again, something that I'll mention. In psychology, there's a bit of a debate between almost what comes first. Does the behaviour trigger the reaction, the emotion, or does the emotion trigger the behaviour?
That is, and like the egg and the chicken.
Exactly. And there was a psychologist called William James. He was one of the fathers of psychology back in the sort of 1890s. He opened is involved in opening the first ever school of psychology at, I believe it was Harvard University. And one of the things he was interested in discovering is, are we happy because we smile, or do we smile because we are happy?
I don't know. I don't know.
The modern thinking is probably that there's a kind of a loop that goes round. But he did some experiments, and these experiments have been replicated down the years, where they've managed to get people to smile, and you might get a chance to have a go at this later, gets people to smile and people to frown without them knowing they are smiling or frowning.
Yes.
And before that, he will measure how happy they feel on a scale of 1 to 10, for example. And then the research suggests that when people smile, they then rate themselves as happier.
Okay.
Than people, even though they don't know they're smiling. And people who frown tend to rate themselves as being less happy. And it creates a cycle. So then once you feel less happy,
okay,
you're less likely to smile. And then you're less likely to feel happy because you're less likely to smile.
Okay.
So it's a real what comes first, okay, as you say, the chicken or the egg. Yeah.
Another example, I think it might be the Marlboro campaign.
Okay.
You know the campaign with the cowboy of
the very old 1950s and 1960s, yeah.
And when we are teenagers, I've never smoked though.
Okay.
Well, when we are teenagers, I doubt if someone that has ever, that when he smoked his first cigarette, he really liked it.
No.
But he felt like he was a rebel, that he was a bit of adventurous, that he was an adult.
Yep, yep. And that's probably true, yes. I mean, this is probably the early days of commercials for smoking.
Yes.
And there's no doubt built at the time around American TV was the kind of the cowboy and Indian type programs, where it was good to be associated with the strong, silent...
The wild,
cowboy,
yes.
The white-hatted kind of, and the big, you know, open vistas of the,
yes,
of the,
yes, exactly.
American...
It was a legendary campaign.
Yeah, it was. Very, very much so. And I think things changed in that arena quite quickly, because it wasn't long... Well, it kind of ran parallel to that. That then they started using doctors and people in white coats to advertise smoking as well. So if your doctor was happy to smoke a certain brand... then doctors are trustworthy. There's something called the white coat syndrome, where humans are more likely to trust somebody if they wear official uniforms.
A uniform, yeah. Okay.
So if doctors in white coats who are clearly clinicians and...
It's like they endorse it.
Exactly, yeah, and we trust them.
Yes.
You know, very often people will... When I speak to people about health campaigns and interactions with doctors, one of the interesting things about it is that they'll sit with the doctor and the doctor will explain situations to them and they'll nod their heads and they'll agree, and then they'll leave the room and have no memory of what the doctor actually said.
Yes.
But the reality...
That happens.
Yeah. But what they trusted what the doctor said, so they could have told them anything. And they would accept it as being the truth because they're wearing a white coat.
The authority that they represent.
And that, going back to kind of the emotions, that stimulates a sense of trust.
Yes.
And trust is a huge emotion. And we spoke about it at the MindSpark event last night, that developing trust as an organisation is very, very difficult, but very easy to lose. United Airlines in the US. Again, you know, when they dragged somebody off the plane, that massively impacted on their value on the stock market. It dropped by something like $250 million dollars in the value. So the emotions that stimulated amongst people watching that event were absolutely incredible and negative, and trust kind of dropped instantly. And people were saying, "I'll never fly with United Airlines ever again because of that policy." So whether again, we get back to the point of whether emotions influence behavior or behavior then influence emotion. In a way, it kind of doesn't matter because emotions are being triggered in some way or other, which is affecting behavior following that emotion. So a behavior might happen. We might internally judge what that behavior feels like. And then we feel, okay, I'm going to feel angry about this, or I'm going to feel sad about this. And then we make a decision based on that, or we behave based on that emotion. The behavior still follows the emotion.
Yes.
So, and then if the emotion triggers first and our physiology changes and then our behavior changes, again, the behavior follows the emotion. So from my perspective in trying to understand humans and human behavior for my clients and the clients that we work with, it's important for me to have almost like emotions as being another tool for me to try and understand how people behave and why they behave that way. Mm-hmm. So then we can help create campaigns or messages or whatever it may be to help the client achieve their goals.
So your clients want to influence this.
Yeah.
How the consumer decides.
Yeah.
What are your clients?
Most of our clients, we're essentially a social marketing agency, which is, for people who probably may not understand, it's using the principles of marketing to do social good.
Okay.
So those campaigns that you speak about where we try to stop people smoking or maybe rethink about their drinking behavior or do more exercise or eat more healthily, amongst other things, they're what we would call social marketing campaigns. Okay. And they tend to be run by government or local government or maybe in the UK, the National Health Service. So in a way, we're kind of lucky that most of ours is for good purposes. So our clients would be those type of people. But we do also work for some private sector clients where obviously their intentions are slightly different about how they change behaviour. So for example, we've done work for Unilever product testing. And they wanted to test products to see what differentiation people had, but also what emotions those products bring out in people.
Okay.
So then they can use that in what they call product claims. You may have seen them on commercials on TV where 75% of women who choose this product love the way it made their hair feel, etc., that type of claim. So we use the kind of same processes for those private sector clients as well.
And you use colors, for example, the smells and everything.
We don't do too much sensory-based research. Ours tends to be more focused on kind of interactions with people, what language they use, how they talk about products and services. So we use a range of techniques, such as getting complete diaries about how they feel.
Okay.
And we tend to try to get those to use kind of the third person. So they talk about themselves as another person.
Okay.
So instead of saying, I do this, they'd give themselves a name and talk about it that way. And that gives us that little step backwards away from, we tend to judge ourselves when we talk about ourselves and the language we use. So if you can take a step away from that and talk about yourself as another person, you tend to put fewer value judgments against your behaviours and your thoughts, which means you get more depth of information that's of value.
Oh God, this is
complicated.
It's complicated, and it's, I don't know. It's
maybe I'm making it more complicated.
We are subsequently influenced by all this stuff.
Yeah.
I mean, do brands take advantage of our insecurities? Totally. Yes.
Yeah. I watched a video on YouTube a couple of weeks back, and this was about the treatment of animals and food.
Okay.
Systems and how marketing and advertising is used to kind of mislead the consumer by putting things like farm-reared animals.
Okay.
That it can be a farm, but it doesn't mean that they're not reared in kind of factory farming, you know, all close together, crammed in. It's still a farm, so you're not lying, but it gives it, when you use the word farm, as a consumer, you tend to picture wide open spaces, lovely green grass, animals running free.
Totally, sheep and cows.
Exactly. But that isn't necessarily the farm that they're using.
Yes.
And one of the outcomes, the final comments on this this video was that the most powerful tool that advertisers have is you as a consumer.
Yeah.
Because we are willing to accept and not question comments like farm-reared or you know, natural, all natural.
Yes.
We don't question those claims. And then we become advocates of a product. And we get into habits, so we buy the same product over yes. and over again.
Yes.
And we don't question it. So they use us against ourselves to sell our yes. products. And I'm not, you know, I use some of the same principles in
yes.
the way I think about things.
You can't escape that either.
It's a very difficult thing to escape escape marketing. You've been marketed yes. to constantly. And it's becoming more and more difficult and problematic with things like Facebook
yes.
and Google, because they use certain algorithms that means that you as a consumer are only presented with products and services that you agree with.
Yeah.
You don't tend to see information about things you don't agree with. So you're just reinforcing constantly the same products, the same services, the same opinions over and over again.
Yeah. Really difficult to escape this, yeah, yes. Yeah. I mean, it comes to mind the brand Abercrombie and Fitch.
Yep.
So you're in New York, you uh-huh. walk down the street,
yep.
and you're passing by outside of a Abercrombie and Fitch store. Mm-hmm. First, there is a gorgeous smell. So you just go into the store mm-hmm. just from the smell. So this is marketing.
Yep. Yeah, of course, yeah. And the way the way stores are designed. I'm lucky, one of my old school friends from many years ago, he works for a company who are in advertising and marketing, and they've reached the point where all stores are designed specifically to attract consumers to certain products.
And make you want to stay there.
Exactly.
Like the Apple stores.
Yeah, yeah.
Or the Starbucks.
And they have at their company a room that is essentially just a white room. And people come in as consumers, put on virtual reality headsets, and they project stores and get people that can reach out as though they were grabbing products. So they can actually design stores in even more detail using virtual reality.
Yes.
So the impact of store design and psychology is only going to get more and more advanced as we reach Amazon stores where there'll be no staff, for example.
Yes, I read about this.
Yeah, and they're going to have to be designed to such an extent that it's going to be such a simple process.
Yes.
But almost like you have IKEA in you probably pronounce it differently.
I'm not sure. Yeah, IKEA.
Yeah, IKEA. Yeah, the furniture store.
Yes, of course we have.
I can't remember what I was going to say there now. No, I've lost my train of thought. But anyway.
No worries. And maybe this is the reason why nostalgia marketing works as well.
Yeah.
That you
give
see,
me an example. What have you seen?
Mad Men.
Classic program. Yeah.
I love Mad Men.
Yeah, it's fantastic. I think I've watched it about 3 times as a series. And the
but
ending,
you see the packaging of many brands to be to remind how it used to be at during the 60s, for example.
Yeah. And again, what are they selling to you at that point?
What are they selling to me?
Yeah.
Explain to me, because I'm really attracted to this, and I'm a millennial, you know?
Yeah, yeah. If you think about, you get adverts for a TV commercial for Coca-Cola on TV.
Yes.
Can you describe an advert, a commercial? Yeah, what do they look like?
Happiness.
Mm-hmm.
Of Coca-Cola. I think... Mostly young people hanging around together and happy and mm-hmm. smiling.
Yep.
And I think that's mainly.
Yep. So they're not miserable. They're
No, not at all.
They could be on the beach. They could be all usually in bright clothes and kind of happy. That's selling you a product, but it's not. The product is barely mentioned. You'll
yes,
see
true.
People with it.
You see the color of Coca-Cola. Yep.
And they're selling you the lifestyle.
Yes.
Attached to it. And if you emotionally buy into the lifestyle, yeah, that's me, that's what my friends are like. That's what we do.
Yes.
Every Friday evening we go to the beach and we sit and
yes.
have a fire burning or whatever it yes. may be. And we're so all happy and grateful. And why not have a Coca-Cola while you're there?
Yes.
So it's almost not subconsciously pushing the product in your direction, but just subtly saying, you know, this goes with that.
Yes.
You know, that you're kind of linking the two together without overtly saying, buy Coca-Cola.
Yes.
Yeah. You know, so they're selling you the lifestyle, you know, like we were saying with the cars. If you've got the freedom to drive with all the cars on the road, imagine how great it would be if you were sat in this beautiful car.
Yes.
And you're just driving with your partner, your girlfriend, boyfriend next to you in the seat and all happy and smiley with each other.
Yes.
We know in reality that driving is not like that.
No, 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 at all.
Most of the time.
What else? How does and packaging influence yeah. our yeah. decisions?
Yeah, I did some work again for one of our clients. It was just a small number of focus groups recently, and they are redesigning or thinking of redesigning some of their packaging for hair products. And there's some debate within the group about what the packaging should look like and whether it should be a package where there was a base and you lifted the lid on the top.
Okay.
Or whether it was one of those that you could stand the other way up so the lid was on the bottom and you flicked it open. And that is a big decision about a package because how customers use those bottles and perceive those bottles when they're using, whether they get angry about not being yes. able to get all the product out.
So it has to be user-friendly, yeah. but...
And the shape
for
has
me,
to be...
it has to be sexy as well.
Right. So the shape of a bottle has to be... And,
sexy.
And the color, yeah,
Coca-Cola
yeah.
bottle is sexy.
It is. And what shape is that
for,
based on?
For certain categories, it's really important, the packaging.
Yeah.
For example, wines.
Okay. Tell me more.
I have bought wines
yeah.
judging by the label or the name.
Okay. And what was it? Can you remember what was it about those labels that made you feel attracted to it?
Yeah.
Go on.
There is a Spanish wine that it shows a sky full of stars.
Okay.
The name is Celestial.
Yeah.
And it was, I liked the colors, I liked the name. And maybe the wine that stands next to it, it tastes better. But if the label is ugly, I'm not going to buy it.
No, no. And companies that produce these things pay a lot of money to put their products in certain areas of the shelf.
Yes.
You know, eye level, for example.
So for me to see it first.
Exactly, yeah. Yeah, and not only, obviously, that they're putting it in the right place, they want to put the right product for the right customer in the right place. So for millennials, they'll put products in certain areas, whereas for older customers... they'll have a different look to the
old fashioned, maybe.
Maybe, or kind of traditional, shall we call it. And maybe at different heights on the shelf.
Yeah.
So we're getting different levels. And the end of.
And there are some iconic examples where the packaging is more famous than the brand,
mm-hmm.
with the example of Tiffany.
Okay.
Tiffany, the jewelry.
Yep.
I mean, the box of this turquoise.
Mm-hmm.
Of Tiffany jewelry is like universally known.
Yeah.
It's Tiffany blue, the color. Even the color has the name of the brand.
Yeah. And it takes a long time for brands
to build
up that.
It takes a long time and a lot
collateral.
Of research, I think.
Yeah, and lots of money. You know, you like to watch Mad Men. The
yeah.
budgets they spoke about in the 50s and 60s were huge amounts of money. And it takes a long time for a brand to develop that kind of... It goes down to kind of trust. You know, if you get purchased or go and purchase something from Tiffany, you've got an expectation of what the product will be like,
yes,
how good it will be, the service you're going to get when you go in there, the packaging that goes with it. So you have an expectation, and if that falls, your
yeah.
expectation falls, that is a huge dent for you as an individual with that organisation. And we were talking about it last night about the idea of trust. And how some organisations manage to maintain it. For example, Apple have got high levels of trust because of their customer service. the fact that you've got to take your Apple product to an Apple store to get it seen to, but you'll get a great service when you get there and they'll look after you.
And that is true.
They'll do the best they can. Compared to someone like a Samsung, there's fewer Samsung stores around. The products do virtually identical things, but the service that goes with it is slightly different. And where Apple falls down, where they lose trust, is the fact that people complain about the battery life of the phones not being long enough, and that the cables, when you're the charger cables, break easily. Yeah. And that's where the you know, the great on customer service, great on most of the products, but the negatives around certain elements on the edge. So if they could fix those, they do even better than they are.
Okay. Yeah. So the MindSpark audience and my podcast's audience are people who run their businesses or they sell different brands. Mm-hmm. What would you say to them as a piece of advice to think, to ponder, to do so as to build a brand that the consumers will see it as a sexy or as a trustworthy?
Yeah.
Is there an advice or it is a more complicated thing?
Again, it's something I'll speak about later, but there's an area that seems to be, I suppose, like the new area of competition, I suppose, is customer service at this point in time. Lots of these products and services are very, very similar. Again, going back to Apple and Samsung, they essentially do the same thing.
At the end of the day, yes.
They do the same thing, just in slightly different ways.
Phones and social media and...
They all do similar things. So the way to... There's kind of marginal gains in there, which, you know, it's small ways you can gain an advantage over your competition. And many companies at this moment in time are seeing customer service as being that where they can make the gaps bigger. So if I was talking to a business or some of our clients, my starting point would be to consider, what is your customer service like? What's the experience like for your customers?
Is it very important, isn't
it? Yeah, it is very important because, you know, if you visit a store and you don't get the service you wanted, you tend to maybe think, I'm not going to go back there. And you maybe tell your friends, I went to that store and it wasn't that good. And they were really rude in there and they didn't want to speak to me, or they were
And they will share it with their friends.
And it's just, so what companies are trying to do is really, really understand who their customers or service users actually are. And in the past, that was generally done by what we call demographics or socio-demographics. And that would be things like income level, the area that you live, your education level, the amount of money that you earn. So this kind of, in the UK, we have the socioeconomic group of A, B, C, 1, C, 2, D, E, and that's across the board, from A's being the most, I suppose, successful, earning more money and higher ranked jobs, I guess, down to people who are in the E's, who are people who are probably unemployed, maybe receiving benefits from the government. So a lot of the campaigns and designs for messages or looking at how you could reach those customers were based around that. But things seem to be changing and have been changing probably for the last 5-6 years, where we're taking more into account now things that are called kind of psychographic.
Okay.
Which is more around how people actually behave and interact and their values and how they perceive the world to be.
But how can you measure that? Is this legal? to start with.
As I well know, you have Facebook.
Okay.
The amount of data that Facebook gathers,
Big Brother,
and everyone else gathers is probably beyond your imagination what they have. So all that data is available. We've recently done a campaign for one of our clients, and it was around alcohol use and young people. Oh no, sorry, a different campaign. It was to do with sexual health and a certain group of people, men who have sex with men. So not necessarily gay, okay. But they may sleep okay. With men. And we had to target this campaign specifically. Now, we were doing that via Facebook adverts, and you're not allowed to put into Facebook as your criteria of how you want to target it. So you can target by age and location okay. And et cetera, et cetera. But you can't put in gay men or lesbians or whatever it okay. May be.
Bisexual, so you have
to,
yeah, whatever.
So you have to do research around what kind of lifestyle choices
yes.
fit with that group of people.
Okay.
And one of them, for men who have sex
this
with men
is
with
evil,
men,
okay.
is that they are they're more likely to be Taylor Swift fans, bizarrely. So one of the things we targeted as part of this campaign were people on Facebook who've shown a propensity in this area to be a Taylor Swift fan.
Okay.
So we got somebody emailed us and said, I've had this advert come onto my Facebook timeline, and it mentioned, and I just wonder why it's targeted at me, you know, and et cetera. And he kind of emailed us and wondering why he'd received this advert about sexual health. And my colleague emailed him back and said, well, this is the reason it's happened. And one of the things on your profile, you've probably put that you are a fan of Taylor Swift.
Yes.
And he goes, I am a fan of Taylor Swift. That's okay
that
then. So now he was happy that he'd, not happy that he'd received the ad, but he could understand why. And that's how we are more segmenting audiences okay. now by lifestyle choices, their values, their how they live, which is where one of the things that I'm talking about here, the emotion analytics, is that we can measure now people's emotion responses to things via things like posts on Facebook
okay.
or Twitter feeds, just from the text
or
that people
use. Or from the concert, the last concert I've been to.
Exactly. And including things like if people put emojis in their text, we can use emojis as part of this analysis.
So if I put emojis, means yeah. what?
If you put like a smiley face,
yes.
or if you put, say, happy birthday,
yes.
cake with candles, big yes. smiley face, it's likely that your emotion behind that message is one of joy, etc., you know, something along those lines. So we can, the text that we can take and put through the engine, and it knows that what you've written not only has the content of happy birthday,
okay.
etc., but it knows from your emojis that you mean that in a kind of, it's a positive way. It's around joy and excitement and fun. So okay. we can assign that text to an emotional category. So we can take thousands of pieces of, say, Twitter feeds about a subject, a specific hashtag, for example.
Yes.
We can collect all that data, put it into the artificial intelligence software, and it will categorize everyone's comments into emotions and measure, so the amount of joy that people are showing in these emotions. And that joy is, say it's scoring a 60, for example, out of 100. And then it will give us all the text that relates to that.
Yes.
As to what is it that is driving that joy, or if it's fear, the same thing. So we can measure text. So we can do interviews with people and transcribe all that text.
Yes.
Put it in there, and we'll have your underlying emotions that about how you are thinking and speaking.
I'm speechless. This doesn't happen a lot to me.
No, well...
just so you know.
Okay.
I mean, you cannot even warn us that you will be protected. You just... It is what it is. Well, I mean, enjoy it.
I'm guessing most people have never read the terms and conditions of Facebook when you sign up and you tick the box
true.
And say, I accept. Or they'll email you and say, we're changing our terms and conditions. Do you ever read those?
No, never.
No, most people don't.
Well, they are made that way because it's like tiny, tiny letters.
Yeah, yeah. Some people will read
it.
They
know what they're doing.
But you're probably signing up. I mean, I've never read the Facebook terms and conditions. I've never read Twitter's terms and conditions, etc., or Google's, for example. But I'm sure we're signing up that we're saying that your data is now freely usable for us to give to third parties,
etc.,
etc. And obviously, in Europe, in the last few years, I've had the GDPR, General Data Protection, something or other. And now when websites have to ask us our permission to say, I'm happy for you to use it in this way or not, which makes slows things down because you just want to accept all, and they're all built in there. So all your data is, you don't own it. You know, for example, your music on, you use Apple Music or Spotify or something.
Tell something about me.
If you buy that music,
yes,
you don't own it.
Yeah, I know.
Apple still own it.
I know.
So if you decide to...
So next time that you buy something and after 1 month or two, you say, why on earth did I buy this? Now you know why you know why you bought it.
Exactly, yeah. And things like Spotify, now it pushes things at you. Obviously, like we were saying before about Google, where you just tend to see things that you like.
Okay.
And you've agreed that you like. So you keep seeing the same things over and over again or similar. So you never get to encounter things that are completely outside of your range.
Okay.
So if you have a certain political view, Google's algorithms will just push information your way that you agree with because they want to keep you coming back to use Google or similar, or Facebook will. So you won't see the counter arguments, which in one of the kind of psychological views of this is that we always tend to look for information that supports our own view. So not to bring religion in, for example, scientifically, this is, you know, the atheist side of people who are scientifically saying you have no proof that religion exists. And people who are religious will say, I don't need the proof because X, Y, and Z. No matter what argument you could give them scientifically, they're still going to believe it because they only accept the information that supports their view, and vice versa. You know, you probably won't convince an atheist to become a religious person. So we're going down that avenue of people only getting to see information that supports their own emotional responses about a subject. Hence, in America, people who are Donald Trump supporters will generally only get information that supports their view of being a Donald Trump supporter and will not see the opposite views, and the same for anti-Donald Trump supporters. So it's no wonder that we'll just get more and more entrenched in our views and become harder and harder to change our view because we don't get to trigger emotional responses in any other way apart from, yes, I agree with that. You know, and that's where we seem to be heading.
Nick, I really enjoyed your keynote speech yesterday.
Did you?
Yes. And our conversation.
Yeah, it's an interesting subject. And as I say, I'm not an expert, but I'm learning as I go along. You know, I learned some throughout my psychology, and I'm doing a bit more now. And I'm just constantly seeing how theories and research studies
apply,
and whether we could use something similar, you know, to help help our use of using emotions. And we don't use emotions just purely on their own as part of a research study. We have other ways of kind of engaging with all the data and analysing what people are thinking. But it's just another tool that we're finding really, really useful.
So thank you very much.
My pleasure.
Tell us how people can get in contact with you.
Well, I work for, the company I work for is in the UK. We're called Hitch Marketing.
Okay.
That's H-I-T-C-H, Hitch Marketing. And if people want to email me, it's Nick G. So that's N-I-C-K-G. At hitchmarketing.co.uk.
Perfect. Everything will be on our website as well.
Perfect.
And on the show notes of the podcast.
Yep. Fantastic. So, well, thank you for your time.
Thank you so much.
Great. Thank you.